Every week when we invite the kids up, frequently we ask them questions, and I appreciate the dialogue that Doug engaged in. And kids are great because at a young age especially, they're usually not afraid to answer questions, to put themselves out there and raise their hand. And it's pretty clear, even with my kids, that sometimes they raise their hand and they don't know what they're going to say, but they're confident they're going to say something, and it just comes out. And as we grow up, right, we become terrified of being wrong. And I'm constantly faced with the terror of answering a question wrong. And I don't know if this is true for you, but oftentimes I get asked a question or something comes up in conversation and I don't know what's being discussed, and I'll sort of fake it and pretend like I understand what's being discussed until I figure it out, or just pretend all the way through like I know what's going on. And that was also the case with our daughters when they were born, identical twins. For the first 3 or 4 years, I was faking it as far as whether I knew who was who. And I just flat out guessed half the time. So those of you that have come up to me and say, I still can't tell them apart, don't worry, you're in good company. But Kelsey didn't know that, and she became aware of that one day when they were about 4. It was after we'd moved here, and she saw me flat out guess and get it wrong, and she's like, wait, you're guessing? Yeah, I have no idea. She said, that's not acceptable. You've got to figure it out. You've got to work on that. And so about 90% of the time now, I've got my success rate up to about 90%. And I was wrong this morning. I didn't see them get dressed, so they came in and they left the pew, and I could have sworn that the one in pink was Zoe and it was Eva. So I still get it wrong from time to time. But we hate being wrong, right? We hate the feeling of putting ourselves out there and not knowing what we're supposed to know. And as we go through the Gospels, we see the disciples are constantly in that situation. And bless their hearts, they put themselves out there and open their mouths, and oftentimes they're just wrong. But they're with Jesus, and he's the best person to be wrong around. And so as we turn our attention to the text this morning, we're actually going to work our way backwards through the text. We're going to start in chapter 8, verse 22, and then work backwards and interact with Jesus and the disciples and see what we come away with. Mark chapter 8, verse 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And this is interesting. This is a conventional sort of setting for Jesus. People bring him a blind person or someone who's lame or has a demon, and Jesus lays his hands on him, and there's usually a healing. And here Jesus asks him, "Do you see anything?" And I thought about that this week as we look at this story. That is interesting, Jesus asks him the question, but I also thought interesting from the perspective of this man about what he's going to say. Now, I wear glasses to correct my vision. And before I got glasses, I assumed I didn't need them. I would sit in church and I'd sit in a balcony, much like the one up there, and I just assumed that the pastor's face was fuzzy from that distance, that was just normal to not be able to recognize the person on the platform, to not be able to read the words on the screen. I just assumed that was normal. It didn't occur to me that there was something wrong with my eyes, and so again, I just sort of faked it. No, this is perfectly normal, what I'm experiencing, and then realized I need glasses. And so Jesus asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking around." I thought to myself, what an interesting thing. We don't know whether this was a person born blind that doesn't know what people are supposed to look like, or whether he's seen at some point and then became blind, so he knows that what he's seeing isn't great. But think about what he just said. "Jesus, what you did for me is not good enough. I was blind, but now I sort of see." That's a pretty audacious thing to say. What you did, Jesus, didn't work well enough. And Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." This is the one and only time where Jesus heals someone, and it takes 2 tries. And we shy away from that. We don't want to impugn the power and the might of Jesus. We know he can restore sight to the blind. We know he can heal. The problem is not Jesus, certainly. But the man refuses to accept a partial healing. I would, in that situation, be tempted to say, you know, it was dark, and now I can see stuff. That's huge improvement. Thank you very much. That's good enough, Jesus. I'll take this and go. But this guy says, no. I see people walking around, but they look like trees. He insists on the full healing, and his blindness was stubborn enough that it took two healings from Jesus. The problem is not Jesus. The problem is the stubbornness of the blindness. But this individual shows a similar stubbornness in refusing to accept a partial healing. This story is instructive in looking back at what has come before, which is why we start here. But next week, it will also be instructive for looking ahead. This is meant to be a window into what is going on with the disciples, who are blind, who are dull of hearing, and whose hearts are hardened. And Jesus is saying, it will take more than one try to fix you. And so be patient with me as I work with you to soften your hard hearts, to open your dull ears, and to give you spiritual sight to see what is going on. The problem is not Jesus. The problem is the stubbornness of our condition. And like this blind person, the disciples need to be equally stubborn in not giving up on receiving the truth from Jesus. And so as we back up, and we see what has immediately preceded this. Jesus, at the beginning of Mark chapter 8, feeds 4,000. Last week we saw how he fed 5,000 people. And the disciples were put in the position with their five loaves and their two fish of feeding that multitude. And they said, how can we do that? And Jesus said, exactly. But watch what I'm about to do through you. Similarly, with these 4,000, they've got some loaves, seven loaves, and a few fish. And they pick up seven basketfuls, and there's this tremendous miracle. And then the Pharisees come and say, we demand that you show us a sign from heaven. Which perplexes us, because on the heels of feeding 4,000 people with seven loaves and a few fish, we say, what sign do you need? They're looking for a sign from heaven. Fire falling from the sky, authenticating that Jesus is the Messiah. They're challenging Jesus. And Jesus, in frustration, says this generation will not be given a sign, and then he picks up and leaves. And so we pick it up in verse 14. On the heels of that miracle and that exchange with the Pharisees, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread. And they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out! Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. They take Jesus' warning about the Pharisees and Herod and assume that Jesus is somehow backdoor rebuking them for forgetting bread. And so they're talking about, why don't we have bread? Whose job was it to get bread? Why don't we have any bread with us? And Jesus, verse 17, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? You might underline that. Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? The exercise we went through earlier is so important to the Christian walk, to remember what God has done, because we are so prone to forget. Here these disciples are coming on the heels of two feeding miracles, and they're worried about the fact that they've only got one loaf of bread in this boat. When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 12. And the seven for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? So clearly there is something the disciples are supposed to grasp on the heels of these feeding miracles. And it's not just that. When you're with Jesus, lunch will always be provided. That is not the primary thing that they're supposed to grasp, because Jesus warns them against the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Now, Herod we talked about last week, and Herod's problem of fearing losing his power. And so he set up all of these safeguards, all of these controls to maintain his power. The leaven of the Pharisees is similar. And so as we back up again, in chapter 7, Jesus engaged in a dialogue with the Pharisees because they came to him and they said, your disciples eat with unwashed hands. They violate the tradition of the elders. The Pharisees had built up this tradition around the law to secure the place of God's people. They had learned the lesson of the exile well. When God's people broke his covenant, they were sent into exile to Babylon. And on the heels of that, coming back into the land, the Pharisees were set up as the guardians of the law to ensure that we never break God's covenant again. And so this tradition rises up that expands the law, that makes more requirements and regulations to ensure that we never break God's actual law. It adds to it. And so they come to the disciples and they say to Jesus, "Your disciples eat with unwashed hands, violating the tradition of the elders." And Jesus responds by saying, "Your tradition ends up canceling out God's actual law." And he gives them this example of how a man can dedicate what is due to his parents to support them and dedicate it to God. And he says that tradition ends up violating one of the Ten Commandments, that a man honor his father and mother by caring for them in their old age. And so he turns it on its head. He says, "You're coming at my disciples for violating your tradition. Your tradition often ends up violating God's very law and commandments. You are the ones that are in error." And in response to that, he calls the people, verse 14, to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. Jesus' parables, as we've talked about, are these teachings that get at truth from a roundabout route. They don't make it obvious. And what Jesus has said on its face is not obvious to us. And went against the grain of the thinking of the Jews at that time, who would say that, yes, there are all these dietary laws. Food does render you unclean. There are things out there that render you unclean and unable to enter God's presence. And Jesus has said something sort of mysterious and perplexing, this parable. And so his disciples ask him to explain, "What do you mean by this?" And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding?" Take note of how often Jesus is asking his disciples that. "Don't you get it? Haven't you understood yet? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean." Jesus talks about now what he calls the leaven of the Pharisees. Herod's leaven was all of those safeguards that he'd put to keep his power and place. And the Pharisees' leaven is very similar. They've set up all of these safeguards, all of these boundaries, so that they can know who is part of God's people, who is clean and worthy to enter the presence of God, and who is not. And it secures their power as the guardians, ensuring that those boundaries are maintained. And so Jesus says, "Don't you understand that the problem is not with things and people out there? Those things don't impact the human heart. It's the things that come from within." And so in verse 20, he says, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts." Now we hear that and we immediately say, "Well, yeah, we get that. We're not like the Pharisees. We don't have these rules that we follow, that we use to delineate. We're not legalists. We're not like those people." And I would caution us, because as I've interacted with this, I have found that we, as humans, fall into this all too easily. And we need to hear what Jesus is saying. That from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts. And under this category of evil thoughts, Jesus lists 12 things that proceed from within us. The term for evil thoughts there is the same word as the word for dialogue. It means that there's this internal discussion that goes on in our hearts. And all of us, I think, experience this. That when we're interacting with our world around us, there's this inner dialogue that we often don't let out. Or we try not to let out. We try to pretend like it's not going on. Between what we know is not right, what is not okay, and what we know is expected of us, and all of these pressures that work on our souls and hearts and determine our mode of behavior. And Jesus says it's from that inner turmoil, that inner dialogue, that inner conflict, that the following things come. And there's three pairs that start this off. sexual immoralities is paired with adulteries. It's interesting that Jesus begins with that. The root of sexual immorality is a disregard for the dignity and worth of other people. It objectifies other people. Similarly, thefts and covetousness. The desire for what other people have, not regarding that they need it and that it is rightfully theirs. And finally, murders and malices. And here we are reminded of the Sermon on the Mount in each of these categories that Jesus says it's not just the actions. It is the heart that produces them. And so this first set of six is paired up to highlight three of the most prominent and obvious of the Ten Commandments. And we might look at these six and say, okay, I feel okay. Not great, but I feel okay about those things not necessarily coming out of my heart. But it's the second set of six that arrested my attention. Deceit. How many of us can say that we are without deceit? Within our hearts, with our words, in our interactions with other people, that we are honest and transparent at all times. Not just in the big things, but in the little things. Sensuality. Being driven by our senses, by what feels good. How many of us can say that is not at the forefront of what drives our decision making and our lives? The pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of comfort. The next one, envy, is how it's rendered in the ESV, is literally the evil eye. The eye that looks at others with envy, with jealousy, that resents the good that comes to others because it hasn't come to us. The evil eye. How many of us have that? Blasphemy, it's rendered slander in the ESV. And James reminds us that it is impossible to praise God and curse our fellow man. And so to slander other people, to speak ill of other people, and how easy it is to do that in private, away from them, or on social media, where it feels like there's not that many consequences to our words. And by slandering our fellow human, we blaspheme the name of God, because our fellow human is made in his image. Pride. This has the sense of a haughtiness, a looking down. The Greek word for pride has this sense that you're standing above and looking down in judgment. Someone this week told me that they've thought of pride not just as the opposite of humility, but as this sort of smugness. This sense that I'm okay, everything's all right with me, and it's easy to see how other people are not okay. Finally, foolishness. All of this is foolishness because it refuses to understand that we live in God's good world and he's ordered it to work according to his character and nature. And so as we work through that list, as we look at that, I hope you begin to see that the problem is me. The problem is what comes from within. And Jesus is pointing to the Pharisees and to Herod and warning his disciples, don't be led astray to think that the problem is out there. That the problem is things or other people. The system of Herod, the system of the Pharisees for navigating life, says, I will build up boundaries around myself to keep myself safe from what is out there. And that feels good. That props me up and makes me feel safe. But Jesus says you're protecting yourself from the wrong things. And so in verse 24, he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. On the map there, Tyre is the red dot, Sidon is further to the north. The main point here is it's far outside the boundaries of the people of Israel. And when it says he went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, the word there that's rendered region throughout our New Testament literally means he went into the borders of, he crossed a boundary, he left one place and went into another. On the heels of this conversation about traditions and laws and boundaries, And what do we need to protect ourselves from? Jesus crosses a boundary, and not just any boundary. It's not just the boundary between the Jewish people and the Gentile people. That would be one thing, and Jesus is intentionally doing that. And the feeding of the 4,000 that follows this takes place on the other side of the Sea of Galilee in Gentile territory. It's probably mostly Gentiles that number that 4,000 that he feeds. But this is the territory of Tyre and Sidon, and the relationship between Tyre and Sidon and Galilee in particular is not a friendly one. Galilee sent tribute, a burdensome tribute, to Tyre and Sidon. It was the labor and the oppression of the Galileans that made the comfortable lives of the Tyrians possible. And Jesus goes there. And he encounters this woman. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. The fame of Jesus has spread beyond the land of Israel. And in verse 25, immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. Mark's very specific to say not only is she a woman, we know the scandal of women in this society. She's a Gentile woman, but she's not just any Gentile. She is Syrophoenician. She is a member of this city that is responsible for the oppression of Jesus' people. She is someone from whom the Jews of Galilee probably felt they needed to be protected, that a wall or a barrier might have been a good idea. And Jesus has crossed into her territory, and she comes to him and falls down at his feet because her daughter has an unclean spirit. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now we need to pause there. First of all, note that there's this continuing theme of bread in all of these discussions. And so when we hear Jesus ask the disciples, "You were there for the feedings, don't you get it?" And he warns them about the leaven, which is the primary ingredient in making bread bread, of the Pharisees and Herod. And then he says to this woman, "Let the children be fed first." And the term for fed there is the same term that was used of the satisfaction of the crowds that were fed by Jesus. Let them be fully satisfied first. "For it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." So there is definitely a connection between the feedings that Jesus has done and the warnings that he's issued to his disciples about the problem with Herod and the Pharisees. But then there's this contrast between children and dogs, and we have to deal with that. And commentators are eager to rescue Jesus from himself here and say he's not calling this woman a dog. He is not certainly giving in to the cultural norm of the time and saying that the Jewish people are the children of God and Gentiles are dogs. And there's two words for dog in Greek, and one is for the wild street dog, and one is for the household pet, and he uses the term for the household pet here, and a lot of commentators are saying, see, he's softening it, he's indicating a friendly posture, and I would just ask you all whether or not being called the household dog really makes a difference in not being an insult, and just ask yourself how much money you'll spend to save the life of your dog versus your child, and hopefully there is a difference. And we're offended. Jesus is always polite, right? Because the height of righteousness and holiness is politeness. Not if we read the Gospels carefully. He calls Herod a fox. He calls the Pharisees broods of vipers. He calls everybody hypocrites right and left. He calls them a wicked and adulterous generation. He calls them sons of the devil. He calls them murderers. When you look at it, Jesus is constantly insulting people, publicly and unapologetically. But I don't think he's insulting this woman. He's pushing against her, saying, "You know the way of things, that the Jews are God's chosen people, the Gentiles are not." He's calling attention to the outlandishness of her request on its face. But I don't think he's refusing her. When we look at verse 28, she answered him, "Yes, Lord," significant how she addresses him, "yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." She refuses to leave without receiving what she needs from Jesus. She has sought him out. She has come to him and she has said, I am in need. I have nothing to offer, but I know that you have what I need. And he said to her, for this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. This interaction with the woman is instructive for us. As we look at the condition of our heart. Because our hearts are just like the hearts of the Pharisees and the hearts of Herod and the hearts of the disciples. Out of our hearts come all those evil thoughts. And all those evil thoughts are directed at putting up barriers between us and other people. Our hearts tempt us to see the problem as out there, never that it's in here. The Syrophoenician woman knows her poverty. She knows what she does not have, and she knows she must ask for it open-handedly from Jesus. And Jesus warns us that our traditions, these things that we set up to protect ourselves, give the illusion that we are not in desperate need. We have done what we need to make ourselves clean and acceptable before God, and those other people have not. And it's hard for us to reckon with that. And this week, I've had occasion to think through what is it for me, because my knee-jerk reaction is to say, yeah, this is not me. I'm not a Pharisee. I haven't done this. And I would remind you that deceit is one of the things Jesus says comes out of the human heart. And I've been confronted with this yesterday. One of the traditions growing up in a middle-class American home of Anglo-Saxon Germanic descent is that hard work is its own reward, and that if you work hard, you will reap the benefits of that. Now, that is a good and valuable tradition, and we need to be honest and say that much of what the Pharisees said and did, Jesus said, do what they tell you. They sit in the seat of Moses. There's a value and a rightness to what the Pharisees put out there, and yet their hearts corrupt it. And that's why he says their traditions end up violating God's commandments. That's a perfectly good and righteous thing. Read Proverbs. Hard work paying off is a good and biblical principle. But here is what my heart does with that tradition as an upbringing. I flip it around and make it a boundary. Because by implication, I look at my life and say, I'm comfortable. I have what I need. And that is the result of my hard work. And therefore, those that do not enjoy a comfortable, prosperous lifestyle, the problem must be them. And so when I hear in social discussion the statistics regarding the gap in prosperity between whites and people of color, I will admit freely that my default inward assumption is a smug satisfaction. Well, clearly, the problem is with them. My tradition informs me of that. The deceptiveness of my heart sets up a boundary to protect me. And here's what I'm protecting myself from. I'm protecting myself from the truth that what I have is not the result of my hard work. What I have is the gracious gift of God. And particularly in this issue where we look in society and we can easily draw lines between us and the groups that are disadvantaged, all I had to ask myself yesterday, if the color of my father's skin had been different, could my story have ended the same way? And the answer is an automatic and obvious no. That so much of what I have is owed to something I had absolutely no control over, and neither did my ancestors. My ancestors were born in Germany and so could come to this country 300 years ago freely, and their hard work could pay off. But if my ancestors had been brought here against their will from the continent of Africa, my story would be so much different. And so what the Syrophoenician woman understands, and what the disciples do not, and what the feedings are intended to show, is that your effort can produce nothing apart from the gracious activity of God. That all of us stand in need of changed hearts. And our hearts teach us to put up barriers to distinguish. Say, no, I'm better, I'm different, I'm okay, the problem is out there. And that's what we do. And so I'm going to invite the choir to come forward, and they're going to lead us in the song, Change My Heart, O God. This is our posture, that we stand with open hands before God, like the Syrophoenician woman, and recognize that He has everything that we need and we bring nothing to the table. And here is the good news. The good news is that Jesus is good news for the deaf, the dumb, and the blind, if we will admit that we are in that category. Let's continue in worship.